Welcome back to the Maritime History Program, here, as always, on Boat Radio. I'm Brandon Huebner, and today we have Episode 11, Harappa and the Erythraean Sea. Today, we leave ancient Egypt behind, roll back the clock, and shift our geographic focus about 4,000 kilometers to the east. That's 4,000 kilometers by air, though. If we were traveling by sea from an Egyptian port on the Red Sea east to Mumbai, India, we'd have to tack on at least another 1,000 kilometers, giving us a sea voyage of 2,750 nautical miles. Anyway, our next port of focus is India, or the Indian subcontinent, to be technical. This region, and the Indus River Valley specifically, is the third point in the triangle of civilizations that we've looked at so far. The Mesopotamian cultures lying at the north end of the Persian Gulf, the Egyptian Red Sea ports strewn along the Red Sea's western coastline, and now the Indus peoples, far to the east on the other side of what the ancients called the Erythraean Sea. We now refer to it as the Arabian Sea, the body of water that's bordered by the Horn of Africa, the Arabian Peninsula, and the western coast of the Indian subcontinent. The word erythra in Greek means red, so the Greeks and Romans called the Arabian Sea the Red Sea, not to confuse it with the separate body of water that bears the name Red Sea in the modern atlases. A Greek writer commented on the roots of the name Erythraean Sea by saying, quote, "And they say that the sea called Erythra, or red, is of a deep blue color, but that it was so named, as I said before, from a king Erythras, who gave his own name to the sea in question." Now, despite this ancient claim, it is probably more plausible that the sea, just like today's Red Sea, gained its name thanks to the annual blossoms of the red-colored Trichodesmium erythraeum near the water's surface. These are organisms that are also known as sea sawdust, and they're some type of bacteria that I don't really understand. I didn't spend a lot of time researching them, and I'm not well-versed in my science knowledge. So I can't really explain them to you properly, beyond the fact that some of them appear a reddish hue in the water, and that sailors on the water where these organisms are present say that the water takes on a reddish color. Moving on to the history here more so, on a broad level, I think it will be helpful for us to understand the cultures of the Indian subcontinent as part of a maritime system, because much of what we know about the ancient peoples of the region, and their maritime exploits in particular, well, all of this knowledge comes by way of their connection to Egypt or Mesopotamia. The early cultures of the Indian subcontinent didn't leave us much in the way of a written record, and for the earliest of civilizations there, we haven't even deciphered their pseudo-writing system yet. More on that here in a minute, though. Before we home in on the oldest known civilizations of this region, let's get a broad view of the role that monsoons play in connecting the three regions that we have just listed. Our best source of information about the region from a maritime perspective comes from an anonymous work written by a Greek Egyptian in the 1st century BCE. This work is called The Periplus of the Erythraean Sea, and although it comes from a much later period than the time period we'll be talking about today, it is a good jumping-off point for our purposes. The Periplus is a 68-chapter description of the coastlines around the Indian Ocean, including descriptions of the major port cities, the goods that could be had at each port, and a whole lot more beyond that. The most interesting descriptions, in my opinion anyway, involved the sailors' navigation tips about how to reach these locales and the dangers for which to keep a lookout. In several places throughout the Periplus, the writer mentions a month of the year during which he suggests that you begin your journey to or back from India, since the seasonal monsoon winds make the journey much quicker when they are at your back. I tried to summarize how the monsoon winds work myself. It can be a little bit confusing, especially if you're reading about them and not looking at a diagram. But in the end, I think it will be more helpful if I just pull a paragraph from a book by Brian Fagan, a book named Beyond the Blue Horizon. This describes the importance of the monsoon winds to the region and to history as a whole. In this book, the author writes the following. The secrets of the monsoon were common knowledge around the northern Indian Ocean, sometimes called the Arabian Sea, long before recorded civilization. In these usually benign waters, the monsoon winds blow from the northeast from November to March, and somewhat less predictably from the southwest between May and September. Summer heat warms the continental landmasses north of the ocean. The hot air rises and creates a low pressure zone at the Earth's surface, causing moisture-laden air from the sea to move into the low pressure area. As this air climbs on rising air currents, rain-bearing clouds bring monsoon rains. In winter, the pattern reverses, for the ocean cools more slowly than the land. The winds now blow toward the ocean. The northeast monsoon wind is the major player, a lovely breeze that blows virtually continually, never at gale force, almost never dropping to a flat calm, never changing direction dramatically. This is a sailor's delight. Indeed, it was and continues to be the sailor's delight. The sailor who wrote the Periplus was intimately acquainted with the monsoon winds, telling his readers that most sailors left Africa in July en route to the Indus River Valley, so as to take advantage of the winds. He says that it is more dangerous then, but through these winds the voyage is more direct and sooner completed. Of the Indus River Valley itself, the Periplus says that from it flows the River Cynthus, the greatest of all the rivers that flow into the Eritrean Sea, bringing down an enormous volume of water, so that a long way out at sea before reaching this country, the water of the ocean is fresh from it. Now, as a sign of approach to this country to those coming from the sea, there are serpents coming forth from the depths to meet you. And a sign of the places just mentioned, and in Persia, are those called Greya. This river has 7 mouths, very shallow and marshy, so that they are not navigable except the one in the middle, at which, by the shore, is the market town Barbaricum. Now, I can't vouch for the validity of the serpents that supposedly met arriving sailors, and the Greek word here, Barbaricum, refers to the port city of Karachi, Pakistan, but more generally the word barbaric, barbarian, was used to describe any regions that the Greeks or Romans felt were outside civilization proper. The author of the Periplus also had a negative opinion of the Arabian Sea as a whole. He wrote this as well. Navigation is dangerous along this whole coast of Arabia, which is without harbors, with bad anchorages, foul and accessible, because of breakers and rocks, and terrible in every way. The writer's description of the Indian coastline also paints a bleak picture. Even after taking advantage of the monsoon winds to speed up the journey, a choice that apparently carried some risk, but even then, arrival in the Indus Valley region carried different risks altogether. Once you got past the sea serpent greeting party, of course, you then had to deal with treacherous coastlines and deceptive inlets. the Gulf of Arinon and the Gulf of Baraka, the modern-day Gulf of Kutch, was especially dangerous, being described like this. The water is shallow with shifting sandbanks occurring continually and a great way from shore, so that very often when the shore is not even in sight, ships run aground, and if they attempt to hold their course, they are wrecked. A promontory stands out from this gulf, curving around from Arinon toward the east, then south, then west, and enclosing the gulf called Baraka, which contains 7 islands. Those who come to the entrance of this bay escape it by putting about a little and standing further out to sea. But those who are drawn inside into the Gulf of Baraka are lost, for the waves are high and very violent, and the sea is tumultuous and foul, and has eddies and rushing whirlpools. The bottom is in some places abrupt, and in others rocky and sharp, so that the anchors lying there are parted, some being quickly cut off, and others chafing on the bottom. As a sign of these places to those approaching from the sea, there are serpents, very large and black. For at the other places on this coast and around Berigaza, they are smaller and in color bright green, running into gold. So there are more serpents, apparently, and at least here there are a variety of colors to keep things interesting. This entire look at the periplus of the Eritrean Sea is to say basically this. The monsoon winds in the Arabian Sea played a huge role in connecting the Indian subcontinent with Egypt and Mesopotamia. A little side note here before we move on to look at the people who populated the region that we're now looking at. I was caught in two minds about whether to record the Periplus as a supplemental episode, like I did with the tale of the shipwrecked sailor. The positives are that it's packed full of fascinating info about the writer's perception of the people and cities around the Arabian Sea. But the negative is that it's rather lengthy, and that many of the city names aren't readily recognizable without some translation to their modern equivalents. In the end, I did opt to record it as a supplemental episode, although I apologize for the injustice that I certainly did to many of the names involved. If you'd like to listen to a recording of the Periplus, head to the show page on Boat Radio and follow the link to my main website where all the various supplementary materials are also available. Don't feel bad if you ignore the entire Periplus, though. The main points are definitely contained in today's episode of the program. Now, though, let's move on to the details that we know about the oldest civilization from the region, the Harappan civilization, also known as the Indus Valley civilization. As you may suspect from the name, this civilization was centered on the valley that tracks with the Indus River. The river itself, and many of the large Harappan cities, being located in modern-day Pakistan. The Harappan people also spread east and into modern-day India, especially along the Gujarat coastline, where one location that we'll talk about later is located, the ancient city of Lothal. So we know the location of the Harappan people and their civilization for a start. That is the good news. The bad news is that there's still so much we don't know about these ancient people. Sites that are now identified as Harappan were first described in an archaeological sense in the mid-19th century, but it wasn't until 1922 that enough had been unearthed for scholars to connect the dots and reach the conclusion that all these sites they'd been looking at were the remnants of an entire distinct civilization. Subsequent research has landed on the region of 3000 BCE for the earliest signs of the Harappans coalescing into a veritable civilization, the mature Harappan period then beginning around 2600 BCE. It was by this mature Harappan period that the settlement sites of the culture had grown into urban centers that we would call cities. For being a fairly large and early civilization, the Harappan people left a faint mark on the pages of history. Partly, this is due to the fact that these people were on the borderline of being a literate culture. They left plenty of seals, tablets, and pots with their markings, but the language, if we can ever legitimately call it such, has yet to be deciphered. Regardless, almost every instance of these markings is only made up of a few symbols at most, so even if we do decipher their writing system in the future, there's little chance that there will be any substantial literature to come from the Harappan culture. Most of what we know about these people, then, comes to us from the traces that were left lying around in other civilizations. For instance, we know that the Harappan people must have had a vast trade network because pottery, beads, and seals with Harappan writing have been found at numerous locations, including those in Mesopotamia, Egypt, and places along the Arabian Peninsula. Other goods and items that are strewn across ancient sites in these regions include lapis lazuli, mentioned frequently in Egyptian sources, beautiful shells, and goods made of tin and copper. The sites on the Arabian Peninsula are of particular interest. They bring us back something that we saw early on in our look at ancient Mesopotamia, namely their trade with the lands of Dilmun, Magan, and Muluha. Dilmun and Magan are thought to have served as middlemen between Mesopotamia and Muluha, which was the Akkadian term for the people of the Indus River Valley. The bulk of archaeological evidence for trade with Muluha that's been unearthed in Mesopotamia and on the Arabian Peninsula comes from the Akkadian dynasty period of Mesopotamia's history. Right around 2300 BCE, then, when Sargon forged his empire and effectively unified the region, which then opened the way for merchants from the southeast to bring their wares to Mesopotamia. By this time, around Sargon's reign and empire, the Harappan civilization had been growing for quite a while, so by the time Sargon's empire set the right conditions, the Harappans were in a prime position to capitalize on their wealth of resources and the relative lack of natural resources in Mesopotamia proper. As strange as it may sound to those of us who have been conditioned to think of modernity as the pinnacle of man's achievement, even the ancient Bronze Age world was a burgeoning place of long-distance trade and sophisticated exchange between various cultures. While it is entirely possible that the Harappan people sailed west on the Arabian Sea to conduct their trade, archaeological evidence of ships or shipwrecks connected to the Harappan culture is sadly lacking. That being said, the Indus River Valley is aptly named. It's a riverine region where the Harappan people learned the waters, the local waters at least, by heart. Obviously, their goods got to Mesopotamia somehow, and it won't be surprising if we someday find out that the Harappans were enterprising sailors, but at present we just don't have enough hard evidence to draw that conclusion. We do, however, have evidence from the late 3rd millennium BCE that there was a village of Muluhans, likely Harappan settlers, outside the Mesopotamian port city of Lagash. It would be logical that they had gotten there via the sea, though again, it's possible that they hitched a ride on board a Mesopotamian trade vessel, or even that they made multiple connecting stops with short-distance traders between Muluha, Magan, Dilmun, and then finally Lagash. Therefore, we know from evidence along the route to Mesopotamia that the Harappans traded a wide variety of goods with their neighbors to the north and west. Although we don't have evidence of ships themselves from the Harappan period, or even for a while thereafter, we have a few ship depictions that have been discovered at the main Harappan cities. Though keep in mind that research into the many Harappan sites is ongoing, and hasn't been going on for all that long to begin with, so our knowledge of this culture's maritime technology may yet grow extensively in the years to come. The first image that we have right now is a seal impression discovered in Mohenjo-Daro, one of the largest Harappan cities found so far, which is located inland from the sea, but still situated on the Indus River, which would give it access to the Arabian Sea via the river. This first depiction is a fairly crude seal depiction. It shows a boat that is probably a reed bundle boat, like those we saw in Egypt, although some have proposed the possibility that it may even be a planked boat in the alternative. It has a sharply upturned stem and stern, and seems to have been steered with long steering oars. The seal depicts one of the earliest Indian ships represented in Bronze Age art, and though some believe that the vertical structures shown in the middle of the boat depict masts, it seems more likely that the boat simply had a cabin-like structure in the center. The best representation of a Harappan ship also comes from Mohenjo-Daro, but this one is depicted on a terracotta amulet. This boat had a flat bottom with raked stern and prow, and there are two steering oars at the stern. In the middle of the boat, there is a cabin, and at both ends of the ship, a seabird is depicted. These birds were called dishakok, and were used by sailors to find land. There are also two masts on both sides of the central cabin. This ship also seems to be constructed of bundled reeds, again, a method of shipbuilding which was used in Egypt during the Bronze Age. The oldest depiction of a boat found thus far comes in the form of a graffito, found painted on a potsherd, that was also found at Mohenjo-Daro. This depiction is the one that's most likely to represent a planked boat, possibly with a spoon-shaped hull. The vertical and near-horizontal lines above the graffito hull may well be depictions of a mast and yard, and if so, this is the earliest evidence for the use of a sail in the Indus Valley region. I do have a picture of this graffito up on the website if you're curious, but the only one I could find was a reproduction, as it was depicted on the seal for India's 2001 International Fleet Review in Mumbai. So it's not a photograph of the actual potsherd, but it does give you an idea of the type of boat that was depicted, and hopefully it will let you see enough to decide for yourself whether the lines above the hull depict a sail, or if you happen to disagree. As for boat models, not much has been found here either. One item was unearthed in the ancient city of Harappa, a site that takes its name from a modern village located near the former course of the Ravi River. The archaeological convention is to name a previously unknown civilization by its first excavated site, so the Indus Valley Civilization, or the Harappan Civilization, got its name from this ancient city of Harappa. Anyway, that's a bit beside the point. The item discovered at this site is a 6-centimeter-long terracotta item that's been interpreted as having been a toy boat model. For what it's worth, this model shares the traits of the boat depictions that were found at Mohenjo-Daro. They are all flat-bottomed boats, with high prows, a shape that is characteristic of the reed bundle type of boat that was probably used to traverse the river system in the Indus River Valley. As I think I've said at least once today, we don't have any physical ship remains connected to the Harappan civilization. However, the mention of Harappa as a city brings up an interesting point that I was personally astounded by when I first stumbled upon it in my research. the Harappan civilization as a whole consisted of at least 1,000 cities and settlements, although the actual number was probably far greater. The city of Harappa is thought to have had around 25,000 residents, so a fairly large city for the time period about which we're talking. Here's the more amazing part for me, though. The Harappan civilization encompassed over 680,000 square kilometers, more than twice the area occupied by its contemporaries in Egypt and Mesopotamia. Harappan sites across this great expanse shared many remarkable similarities in terms of their material culture, iconography, and settlement pattern, and although there are regional variations, it was the high degree of similarity across this vast area that ultimately led archaeologists to declare the discovery of a new civilization. Now, I can guess what some of you may be thinking, and lest you think I'm straying too far from our maritime history focus, here's my justification for why this tidbit is relevant. The city of Harappa is located far inland on an alluvial plain, thus also far from any significant sources of stone or other building material. The city also happens to be the second largest Harappan site discovered to date, and every single stone found at the site, down to the smallest pebble even, had to have been transported there by some human activity from the surrounding highland areas. Conveniently for the people of Harappa, although the likely reason for why they built the city where they did, Harappa is located in the Punjab region, a region whose name literally means Land of the Five Rivers. Most of the stone used to build Harappa originated from sources at least 120 kilometers away, some types of stone coming from sources over 200 kilometers. So how did they get all of this stone to the site of Harappa at the confluence of the five rivers? Well, the most apparent answer is that transport was accomplished by boat to take advantage of the ubiquitous rivers in the Indus River Valley. This is the likely case, at least to some degree, although one analysis I came across made the argument that the Harappan culture did the bulk of such transport on land, only using boats as ferries to cross the rivers when necessary. As with most of what we've seen so far from the region, we don't have a definitive answer. We know these people were familiar with boats thanks to the few depictions that have been found, but the lack of physical ship remains would suggest that their use may not have been as prevalent as was the case in Egypt or Mesopotamia. That being the unfortunate conclusion that we have to draw based on the current evidence, let's go ahead and turn our attention to the coastal cities and see if we can flesh out how connected the Harappan people were to the sea as opposed to the rivers. The sites we've seen so far, Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro, these were located far inland along the Indus River. The next few sites are all coastal sites, interpreted as being ancient port cities of the Harappan civilization. Many of these sites are situated somewhere in the Gujarat region, which includes the Gulf of Kutch and the Gulf of Cambay, the area that was discussed in the Periplus of the Arithiran Sea as being particularly difficult to navigate. The specific site that's most often mentioned as being important to our understanding of the Harappan maritime trade is the site called Lothal. This site lies at the head of the Gulf of Cambay and has yielded the largest cache of Harappan seals outside Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa themselves. So this site, Lothal, was likely a Harappan port city, even though it lies 800 kilometers away from the Indus River. Many of the seals at Lothal were found amidst the ruins of a building that seems to have been a warehouse, evidence of the city as being a port destination. more controversial evidence of Lothal as a port comes from a specific structure that some have interpreted as being among the world's oldest dockyards. This structure is basically a basin lined with bricks and built into the ground. It is 3.1 meters deep, but it's fairly large, measuring 214 by 36 meters long by wide. There's also a sluice gate at one end to control the water level, and presumably to prevent the basin from overflowing. While this structure is most definitely of Harappan origin, recent interpretations have tended to discount the theory that it was a dockyard. The original proposal was that the structure served as a dock for the berthing of ships that could reach the dock by rivers that fed into the dock basin. Other theories have focused more on the possibility that the basin was an irrigation tank, used to store water for drinking and for irrigation. I do have to confess that I am somewhat skeptical of interpreting the Lothal structure as a dock, simply because it seems too good to be true. We know that Mesopotamia at this period had seagoing vessels and made long-distance journeys. We do also have reference to docks in the literature from ancient Mesopotamia at this period, yet we don't even have any archaeological evidence of a dock from Mesopotamia so far. Compare that to the Indus Valley civilization, where we have no evidence of seagoing vessels, and very indirect evidence of maritime exploits to begin with. Why, then, should we be quick to foist the dock interpretation on this structure from Lothal that could easily have been a water basin or even something else we haven't even conceived of yet? Those are my two bits, anyway. I do think it's also instructive that there's not much evidence of foreign items that have been discovered at Lothal. So if the structure really were a dock for foreign or local ships, I would think there should be more evidence of trade. There are a handful of other coastal sites from the Harappan civilization that have been pointed to as port cities. The majority of them sit west of Lothal. Some of them are west of the Indus River itself, and their presence is seen as being evidence of a coastal trade route that may have been used in conjunction with the middlemen of Dilmun and Magan. Beyond these other sites, our maritime evidence from the Indus Valley civilization is pretty much exhausted, and even the additional sites give us hardly any evidence in the way of maritime artifacts. So, we will go ahead and bring today's look at the Harappan civilization to a close. As we saw in our discussion of Mesopotamia, the Harappan trade with their neighbors to the northwest began to decline around 1800 BCE, and was almost completely dead within 100 years. The speculation is that a drought began the decline, and that once trade began drying up, the decline picked up speed. The Harappan people began to move eastward, settling in the region of modern-day India. This movement, combined with other migration from regions to India's north, resulted in a transition to what historians now call the Vedic period, a period that is well beyond our scope here today. At some point in the distant future, it will be within our scope, and we'll look at India's connections with its neighbors and the other maritime evidence from the Vedic period. But a large part of the Vedic periods was relatively quiet on the maritime activity front, so we'll put a bookmark in it for now. In our next episode, we will leave the Indus River and the Erythraean Sea behind and shift our focus back northwest, this time to the Mediterranean. We've examined the maritime histories of Mesopotamia and Egypt in the Bronze Age, but we've not yet met the cultures of the Aegean and the Eastern Med, those cultures being the Minoans and Mycenaeans. Starting next week, we will begin our look at these progenitors of the Greeks. The Minoans and Mycenaeans were both highly active on the seas, and they bring with them topics like Atlantis, piracy, maritime warfare, some of the oldest shipwrecks analyzed, and of course, the Trojan War and the classic works like the Iliad and the Odyssey. A lot on the horizon then, and I hope you'll continue to join us each week for the Maritime History Program. If you like what you've heard today, visit the program page on boatradio.net. There you can find a link to my main website, where I have supplementary maps, images, source lists, and other beneficial supplementary materials. The website also has info about how you can help support the continued production of this free and independent program. Plus, you can find links to connect with the program on social media for other news and interesting info about maritime archaeology and history. Check back next week and every week thereafter as we progress through the stories of maritime history together. Until next time, fair winds and following seas from me to you. Thanks for listening to the Maritime History Program.